Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So in politics, there is the entertaining, engaging noise of the campaign.
On schools, the environment, unions, fair pay. We're all on our own if Romney has his way.
Independent thoughts are considered subversive because all must agree with our leader.
When it comes to women, preventive care should include coverage of contraceptive services such as birth control.
Ah, the noise of the campaign. And there is the signal. Boring, one voter at a time, actual voting.
A few things to keep in mind when filling out your ballot. First, be sure to mark your ballot according to the instructions at the top of the ballot. And whether you're filling in ovals or connecting the two ends of an arrow, if you do it right, the tabulator won't have any problem reading your ballot.
Oh, turn that off, please. The lively shouting campaign and the quiet, boring process of voting itself. These couldn't be more different. Keeping the important signal distinct from the alluring noise is the key to making any kind of useful predictions about complicated systems. And that is the premise of Nate Silver's new book, The Signal and the Noise. Silver is the author of the New York Times blog 538, Nate Silver's Political Calculus. He came up with a system for predicting baseball performance, a significant upgrade to the familiar Moneyball concept, and his tough, math-driven objectivity has earned him a place on Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World. Nate Silver, welcome to the studio.
Yeah, thank you.
100 Most Influential People in the World. That's got to be a bogus prediction.
I think they were fudging the numbers a little bit, right?
So how is this book different from simply saying a lot of times people get it wrong?
Well, so the book's kind of divided into halves where, first of all, people understand that maybe the world isn't easy to predict, but some things that we think are relatively reliable are not. And vice versa. For example, if you hear on the news, this week we're predicted to create 115,000 jobs in the jobs report that'll be out on Friday. Those numbers are reported without a margin of error, taken as though they're very precise. On average, though, those predictions miss by 70,000 jobs. Sometimes they miss by as many as 200,000 jobs toward either side. So, you know, I think if people realize that, they might be less surprised, for instance, by good or bad economic news.
And the nature of these predictions and reading about them in this book is really interesting. And it reminds me, it takes me back to when I was in television. There is a particular executive that I used to work for at one of the networks who was obsessed with the daily ratings on each day.
Sure.
And people would get screamed at and yelled at based on the ratings being up or down. And another executive at the same network would say, no, that's just the noise. There's a broader trend. And that executive actually ended up running the network.
Yeah.
And we see this all the time, missing this sort of individual piece that might be precise numbers, but it just is irrelevant in terms of predicting the trend.
Yeah, we think if you get more data, then that will always necessarily make your predictions better and your understanding of something better. And it can if you're using the information in the right way. But the problem is if you look at political polls, for example, we get literally 20 or 25 polls every day. Some are high quality. Some are not, frankly. But just because of random variance, you're also going to have some polls that are outliers. And so sometimes what partisans do is kind of pick the two or three polls that they like best for Obama or Romney, as it may be, and assume that describes reality. Or the news media, too, will sometimes focus on the outlying polls because that creates more of a story, right? Like right now,
exactly.
It's a bigger story when you have a poll showing a tied race, Romney coming back, instead of what the average poll shows, which is Obama up 4 or 5. So you kind of cherry pick the numbers to tell narratives or to like fool yourself in other cases. But if you want to make actual predictions, then you have to be more careful about how you use the information presented to you.
Careful. I mean, you have to be extraordinarily disciplined. Nate Silver is the author of the new book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't. How do you maintain the filters required to detach yourself and be objective? Because in many ways, this book is an argument that you can almost never keep from predicting the precise data that satisfies your original sort of wish list.
Sure. I mean, first of all, I think it helps to acknowledge that we all do come to interpreting information with the point of view, right? Not necessarily just a partisan point of view, but in terms of how we grew up and what we're conditioned to kind of like and be entertained by and so forth. But Once you establish that, then you can start to develop a more consistent set of rules for how you evaluate information. So I have, in my case, it comes in the form of a program where we design the program every year in the spring, and then no matter what the poll says, it's a good set of rules, we hope, and it all filters in. So we're using all the information in a careful way to help tell us which direction the race is going on a given day, instead of picking and choosing where then you will be very selective and you will get surprised by how much that can kind of bias your reporting.
Yeah, this book is really a great profile of the herd mentality of particularly financial predictions.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your favorite sort of dreadful predictions leading up to the financial debacle? And how did a friend of this program, Henry Blodgett, seem to get it so right?
Well, you know, Henry Blodgett's a guy who got in a lot of trouble during the dot-com bubble for saying different things, I guess, about stocks to private clients and to in public. But he understands that sentiment, because when he, back in the dot-com age, would go and make a recommendation on CNBC, then you'd see Amazon shoot up by 25%.
Right then.
On the basis of his recommendation
alone.
Yeah,
you could
right?
watch it on the screen.
Yeah, and I mean, which is kind of amazing, right? Because although he's a very smart, persuasive guy, right, there was no change in the fundamental valuation of the stock then. It was just that people didn't really know what it was worth back then, and so he was going to vouch for it, and they were sure that, hey, you know, I'm not sure about Henry Blodgett, but I know that if he's on TV saying this about it, then other people will think that it must be a big deal, and so it creates its own momentum. You still see that now, by the way.
But in the media era, uncertainty. In a moment of uncertainty, mm-hmm. somebody who sounds really certain will move the needle.
Oh, yeah. If everyone's kind of casting about in the dark, right, then anyone who acts like a leader and raises their voice and say, this way, when no one has any idea what the stock is really worth, is going to begin to persuade people. And usually, look, most of the time in most walks of lives, we do want to pay attention to what our neighbors are saying and what they're doing. And so we follow them to some degree, but the problem is sometimes they're leading us off a cliff. And so in the market, when you have that herding behavior, it's helpful to get to a consensus 90% of the time, but 10% of the time you have a bubble or a panic or some kind of deep misvaluation. And that's why this stuff is very challenging. Some of the same habits that are good for us most of the time also mean that we're never going to achieve perfect prediction, and trying to distinguish when we can get ourselves in trouble is a lot of what the book's about.
One of the last chapters is what we don't know could hurt us, but I'm tempted to just ask you, is Obama going to win? Which one will you answer?
Well, we think of things looking at the lessons from people who have made failed predictions. We couch everything in terms of odds or probabilities. So right now we have him as about an 80-85% favorite. And if you go back through history and look at how many candidates who were ahead in the polls at this point in time, October 1st, lost. It's actually not very many at all. In 1948, Truman defeated Dewey. And in 2000, Al Gore had a slight lead in the polls at this point. Although he did win the popular vote, he lost the Electoral College. But so Romney's odds are non-zero, but also not all that great.
Nate Silver, founder of the New York Times blog 538. He's the author of the new book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. And we always want to hear from you.
Yeah, I have a prediction. There are millions of voters who voted for Obama in the last election who swung over to vote for Ron Paul in this election. And now that the Republican Party has, for the second time, pushed Ron Paul right out of the race, you're going to see all those voters swing right back to Obama again, myself included.
What do you think of that prediction? Thanks, Jeff from Michigan. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.